At Giant Eagle, we believe in better. And that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.
Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It's such a great bit of kit. I tell you what, have a look at the black one if you get a chance. I don't know how new that is, but they've been doing a lot of advertising with it. I think it's very cool to have a black kitchen tap. If ever I replace mine, I'm going to go for that, definitely, for sure. If you can afford one, I recommend them. They're so good. You can look at the models at cooker.co.uk. So you get boiling hot water straight from your tap. You get chilled filtered water. Some of the models have chilled filtered sparkling water too, which is just incredible. Sparkling water, which comes out your tap, amazing. Cooker spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. I'd also like to thank them for supporting my new online fitness show. Well, it's not a fitness show, actually. It's called The Health, Fitness and Navigating Life. Yeah, it's so much fun to make. I think I've done four now. We've only put one out so far, but I've recorded four and they're all brilliant. I talked to a well-known face about health, fitness, and obviously how to navigate life. That's why that is the title, Health, Fitness and Navigating Life. The episode up now is with the SAS Who Dares Wins, Jason Fox, where he talks about being in the Special Forces, talks us through the rations and stuff that they eat when they're out on missions. In the field, it's had over 110,000 views at the time of recording this, so it's going up rapidly, so a lot of people are interested in it, and so far most of the feedback has been positive. Obviously, there's some negative reviews, only a couple, but I like that. You know, it'd be terrible if it was 100%. You know, people have got to be miserable because that's, or not miserable, that's wrong. They've got to not see the world that I see it, the way I see it. Or it's very different. You'll see if you go and look at it, it's very different. It's sort of, I've kind of made it so it's very online-y. It's very, I don't know, I'm not going to describe it. I won't do it justice. Go and look at it. I think you'll like it. It's interesting. It's really easy to watch. It's about 10 minutes long, just over. And you get to learn loads. Search Health, Fitness and Navigating Life, or just go to my YouTube channel and subscribe to watch it and future episodes. Today's hour, I'm curious about how modern media is destroying our minds, is destroying your mind. Returning to talk about this is Sarah from the School of Life. You might remember she was on before talking about failure, but this time the School of Life have produced a book called How Modern Media Destroys Our Minds. I have to say this is up there in really important books that I've read. It's made so much sense to me. It's really made me think about the way we structure our lives. And because we all have access to media and it's being, I don't know, it's been put in our lives constantly from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to bed. I would say it is a bit of a must read. Now, I do on this show often, so on this podcast, I often say this book's great, but this one I really think is kind of a must read. It doesn't take long to read, but it really is just kind of makes you see what you're doing and how you're consuming the news and entertainment and everything else and what it's about and how it's impacting your life. And I don't know, I get it. If you can, get it, because it's really good. It really makes you think about everything. It makes you have a look. Look, I tell you what, I'm rambling on here. Let's speak to Sarah. She can tell you all about it. Here she is. Here's Sarah. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Listen, before we get stuck into the book, I think the best thing to do is for you to remind us what the School of Life is for anyone who hadn't listened to the podcast we did previously.
Sure. So the School of Life is a global organization. We're interested in helping people live more meaningful, fulfilled lives. We have a heavy emphasis on thinking about things related to wisdom and resilience. during difficult times, which seem all the more prevalent these days. And we're a team. So we write our books as a team. Our creative director is Alain de Botton, but there are quite a few of us working on all of these projects. The books are the publishing house for the organization as a whole.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the book then. I was just saying how important I find this book in my intro. It's really hit home with me, actually. It's an interesting thing because I think we forget about the impact that media is having, but it is this constant noise that is in the background of our lives, isn't it? It never stops, and it's there throughout every waking moment. You cannot avoid it. If you want to avoid it, you've basically got to somehow opt out because it is constant.
At the British Library, we just did a panel about the media. So obviously I was talking about that book, and it was really interesting because we got an audience that was organic. So they were just people in the British Library wandering around mainly who had, just sat down in the audience. And their newest exhibit is also on the media. And you could just see the sort of heaviness and like frustration and despair of the average person in the audience when they wanted to talk about the news, that they felt extremely compelled to listen to it all the time, of course. But they also felt like it was a hugely painful thing and deeply destructive to their sort of sense of okayness on a daily basis. And that balance sat really heavily. So yeah, we obviously wrote this book essentially for them, for the people like ourselves who feel on the one hand that we need to have a relationship to the media, but on the other hand that something about the way the media works is profoundly damaging for our psyche.
I remember I've said this in so many interviews, but I've been obsessed with TV and the media for a long time. That's why I've ended up in this career. But I remember the first time I got captivated by 24-hour news, and I worked at Sky Sports, and I had a TV on my desk. Now, that doesn't seem unusual now because everyone's got laptops where they can watch everything constantly, but it was really unusual for, I worked in TV, so it was one of the perks of the job. And yeah. I would have Sky News on. I think it was just before Sky Sports News, but I have Sky News or Sky Sports News on constantly. And Versace had just been shot in Miami outside his house. And I remember that whole thing of trying to get as much media from it, as much information as possible, and there was no more information, and yet they kept crossing to people to get more information about Versace. There was nothing apart from a helicopter flying and blood-stained pavement. And I remember this unbelievable urge I had to like just keep going back and going, what else can you give me? What else? There was nothing else because it was just so unusual to see someone like him actually be shot. And I remember that. And then from that moment, I suddenly found 24-hour news just sort of really started leaking its way into my life. And rather than being able to watch the news once a night, which was, historically what people did, or they listened to it on the radio in the morning, suddenly it was all day long, all night long. You could sit and listen to the members of the general public, the bloggers, the politicians, columnists, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it was just this explosion of news which was coming into us. And this book has been wonderful of reminding us how overwhelming it actually is.
Yeah, it hijacks a part of our brain that is deeply interested in urgency, right? Our brain is set up in part to notice immediate threats, immediate possibilities for action. But unfortunately, the news doesn't actually have generally to offer that in reality. So it might say it's really important that Versace has been shot in Miami or whatever, but there's nothing we can do about that, of course. We're just passive viewers. And so we're getting that little sort of urgency button hit in our brain over and over and over. It's urgent. Find out more. Do something. More. And that's what the media is rewarded for doing as well, because people want to sort of hang on their every word when that urgency button is pressed. But in reality, as with so much news, we can't actually take immediate action anyway. And so the urgency is artificial for us. And the other problem, of course, is that what is most recent is not necessarily most important. I would say that for the last 10 years, the most important news item has been global warming and climate change. But it hasn't been urgent in the way that something that happened 5 minutes ago feels urgent. Recency and urgency are not really the same thing as it is. So yes, there's a huge problem with the way our psychology fixates and the way the media takes advantage of that.
Yeah, as the book points out, the media has to keep rolling on as well. We're talking about the news bit here, but, you know, media as a total has to move on. But let's talk about the news. It just has to roll. So I remember a time, and this again goes back to the heady days of around Versace's death, where we had this spate of a couple of people. I think one was a child, maybe one was a woman or something, being killed by dangerous dogs. So every minute of every single news thing was people talking about dangerous dogs and how we had to do something about them. And it felt like as soon as you're going to walk out onto the street, you were going to get eaten by a dangerous dog. And I remember, because I was having this conversation with someone, so I've been sort of aware of this going on, about 3 or 4 months later, going, what happened to all the dangerous dogs? Why did they stop? And it was just the news got bored. They'd moved on to something else that was of interest to them, knowing that it would be even more interest to us. And it does try and keep the news moving as quickly as it can, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you can see it's really just like fashion, right? It's like we have to have, for some reason, and this is, I find it particularly annoying in women's clothing, but perhaps it's true in men's clothing as well. You know, there's a new like dress shape every year for no real reason. And suddenly this is really cool and that isn't. And you can even see it's also true now that we live in little media sort of ecosystems of our own. And so what's fashionable for us might not be for others. And, you know, my friends generally live in like the Guardian media bubble, but I'm always fascinated to see that what's in the Sun media bubble is unrelated. Like it's another country with a different set of fashions. Now there are really serious consequences to that, but as a result, it just means that what we experience as the media every day, all the time, constantly in our brain is extremely artificial and transient and often not that important.
I was talking to a head of a news organization the other day, and she was telling me that one of the most important things to do is to try and get her journalists out of their bubble. And as you say, you're in a Guardian bubble. It's trying to get them so they're not in their whatever bubble there is that they're all in, to try and actually look and see what's happening with other people externally from other news organizations. She also said the job is quite hard because you've got to stop people having bias. And she said the thing which has leaked into news a lot recently is opinion. And she thinks that might not be healthy. Though I think it's the fault of the media is not the media, it's us, because we're consuming it. If we're not consuming it, it doesn't exist, right? So we're consuming it and we want opinion. So this has been the rise of what's happened in the news, is it's not so much here's the facts, it's here's my opinion. And she was pointing out that some of the journalists are now putting opinion in their questions, which is something that is a modern thing over the last 10 years or so. That, you know, I mean, there's always been opinionated news journalists and columnists and stuff, but it's now eking its way into they all feel it's their job to have an opinion on it.
Yeah, I think opinion is it's very useful in terms of getting people to pay attention, because our brains are also primed for conflict. If you look at psychological studies about what people respond to, we love conflict because it seems exciting. It has a narrative behind it, which is very powerful, and it's a little bit dangerous. I mean, of course, lots of things. You and I could now have a debate about, I don't know, income tax or something, and it's not really dangerous. We're not about to stab each other, but some sort of primitive part of our brain is tuned in, clued in for conflict of any kind, because we're social animals and the conflicts we go through are important to our survival and so on. So opinion gets viewers, right? It gets clicks and likes. And there's something about the structure of social media algorithms that rewards it as well. I think that's part of why opinion has become so important lately. Of course, we've always had the same brains. So I think that's an astute observation. I mean, I think it's also worth pointing out that there are really only about 5 successful media companies in the entire world, although it doesn't look like it, right? There are these big shell media companies, and they are run by billionaires generally. And it's worth being, you know, sort of critical, not only of the fact that we're terrible consumers of news, you know, sort of hysterical and not a very objective consumers in many ways, but also that we are sort of fueled by what they want to feed us. And there isn't a lot of diversity in that regard.
Yeah, I suppose it's worth us though pointing out the rise of the columnist is something, because I think we've always assumed there's been columnists, and there has, but I think the rise of the modern columnist, where everybody's trying, I mean, the ultimate one in the world at the moment is Piers Morgan. He's the biggest.
And people are obsessed with him. I would never have guessed until I came to this country quite how persuasive they find him.
Because he's become such a powerhouse. Yeah. In the fact that he doesn't mind what he says, and he doesn't mind of the comeback and the feedback from it all. I remember I did some sports columns, and it was a real eye opener for me, because I was trying to report fact on things like football and stuff. And my editor kept on saying to me, it's too gray. I need black and white. I need you to say, this is always the one I remember. Lovely guy, but he said, you need to say, we need to sack the England manager. And I'm like, no, I don't want to say you want to sack someone's job. And then it's interesting, but because that, if I say, yeah, he's doing all right, he's not brilliant, it's not done, he could do a bit better, that doesn't get, you know, people want the,
it's not
the,
a good headline, as they say,
they want the polarizing opinion, that's what they need. Yeah. And so that is what we've created. So there's no room for gray and nuance in columns. So we're feeding this. And so you just have to listen to one of the chat shows in the call-in shows or one of those things to realize just I can't listen to them anymore because it's just horrific. Pick a side. And then, you know, die on the hill picking your side. And that's basically what it is. But for some reason, we seem absolutely absorbed by it as humans, and we can't get enough of this stuff. Is that a survival thing, do you think?
I think it's partially about our brains, the fact that they are clued in to immediately notice things that look like social conflict. I also think that doesn't mean that we can't, you know, overcome the sort of troublesome areas of our minds. I'm not a pessimist to that degree. I think we can do new things with our old brains, so to speak. And I think one thing that might be interesting to think about, and we were talking about this as well, we were discussing the book in an earlier discussion with some journalists at the British Library, is that we should think about like what the purpose of the news is. And obviously right now, structurally, the purpose of the news is to generate profits for the people that own the news companies. But we could want something different as a society. And when it comes to opinion, I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot, and this comes up a bit in our book as well, but it might be that right now, opinion columnists are often simply engaged in generating as many sound bites as will get likes and clicks on social media. But we could imagine a universe where, yes, we still have opinion. But the role of a commentator and opinionist is actually to teach. And maybe, I don't know, you should tell me what you think. I don't know anything about football, sadly, But you might say that that's the role of a football commentator, right? Is that they're giving the average viewer, who mostly spends their day doing some day job, some insight about how to really understand the sport, maybe the industry, an individual player's choices, etc. They're teaching the viewer how to understand something, even if they have an opinion. And maybe they're even showing them the tricks of how did I form this opinion, and what might somebody who disagrees with me say, and so on. And this is a very difficult skill set when it comes to things that are not sport, in any case, like policy or politics or, you know, whatever. But I always try to think, when I have to give an opinion, that I want to give an opinion in such a way that someone would know how to disagree with me, and that I've given my opponents all the fair coverage I can before I explain that this is how I've constructed my opinion, and this is how the viewer could go ahead and construct their own, basically.
And just whilst we're on columnists, I don't want to move on from this quite yet, because I think they're so important. They used to be like someone would have a column in a newspaper and that would be it, and the rest would be kind of considered news. Now it's more column and less news. That's the change which has happened. That's what more people are consuming, and they're consuming everybody else's opinions. The worst trolls in the world are journalists. They are horrific. Like the worst. I'm on the receiving end of it. So the worst trolling I've had in my life is off journalists. And the problem with journalists is they are setting themselves up as experts, as you say. Now, they've got as much expertise as a degree gets you in a university. That's literally it. Or who's given their job. So one of your mates at the Guardian has absolutely tore me apart once. At a moment that I was in massive depression about something, and he did a whole half page article on why I was rubbish. And I was like, literally not covering it. Well, I couldn't understand why he was doing it at the time. I do now. And I was like, latterly, a few years later, actually a couple of years ago, he's tweeting and campaigning for mental health stuff. And I thought, mate, I just would so love to just remind you of what stuff you used to write about in your paper, but it's slagging people off for absolutely no reason at all. However, because I'm the way I am, I like to try and understand why people do stuff and why they're motivated. This guy has got pressure on him, and all the women columnists out there, because I've had a woman I went to lunch with one week, the week after, absolutely hammered me. And I was like, going, Jesus Christ, we got on really well. We sat next to each other at lunch. And I'm that's not my sort of personality. I wouldn't do that to somebody. But they've got so much pressure on them, these guys. And being that columnist where they asked me to do it, I left the job, by the way, because I didn't want to ask people to resign. That's not how I want to go through my life. I think it's very dark. But they they're trying to hit a deadline. They need to fill up column inches. And in the end, what you have to think about is you have to feel pride in the fact that they are hammering you, that you're newsworthy enough, that they feel that their editor's going to go, great article, you slagged him, loved you off, brilliant, we'll get some people to read this. Yes, he's shit. Let's get him off TV. Let's try and kill his job. Let's do this, let's do that. And what's fascinating about that is you, when you actually understand it, then the sympathy and the empathy goes for the stupid journalist who's going, I've got to pay my kids, feed my kids, or pay for my nights out and my food and my rent and my mortgage or whatever by being nasty to other people. And then you've got to think, this is not a great job. I'll just tell you one more on this, because there is a point to it. Yeah. That I did a TV show and there was a TV critic who was a friend of mine who slagged me off. And I said, mate, and he goes, I actually quite enjoyed it, but that's not how I get my clicks, is it? And I was like, well, I've literally not spoken to him again since. But it's like, what a life are you leading? But we're creating this monster. Their employers are creating it because they know that's what it works. And as you say, it's about making money. But we, as the general public, we are consuming this. And the brilliant point in your book, your mate, which we're going to go into in a minute, is when you create a monster, so I'm the monster in this case a couple of times, you know.
Right, yes, you're the monster figure.
People do not want, I mean, for me, it wasn't like really a monster. They were just saying I'm shit. But they don't want the backstory. They don't want any, you know, the journalist just leaves it, here's my opinion, the guy's an asshole. Not, let's look at his body of work, let's work out where he comes from, let's work out why he's got this angle. And that, I thought, was the bit in the book that I really love, because we create, like, someone's avoided their tax. Monster forever. Rather than go, why did that happen? Where's the investigative, sorry, I'm doing a real monologue here, but this book really hit home with me. Where's the investigative journalist who said, why that person, whoever it was, avoided their tax, and are they as bad as we think they are, or were they badly advised? So, you know, but we'd rather just hang them out as a monster, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It's a really highly personalized media sphere. And this is sort of bad generally, because people like you get sort of, I don't know, crushed in the fangs of random hungry journalists. But it's probably even more important to say, for the listeners especially, that the reason this is bad is not just that we have then like kind of a sort of shit news world where we only hear about terrible people and we think everyone around us is horrible. It's not even that it's a weak form of analysis, that most bad behavior is because we have a structural set of sort of influences that make it necessarily or at least reasonably likely to be so, right? People avoid taxes because we've created a system which is, you know, makes it very easy for certain kinds of rich people to avoid their taxes, and so of course they do, etc. We're not, let's say, very good at structural analysis, and we find that personal attacks work better at getting likes, clicks, etc. So that's troubling. But it's also troubling because of the effect it has on our psyche as consumers, that unlike other media forms, for example, even really long form reporting, arguably, but certainly things like novels or plays, we're not at all looking at the human condition and the fact that all of us are likely to do some really quite bad, sketchy, difficult things in the course of our life. And let's understand how we got here. If you look at the structure of a tragedy in particular, we always talk about this when we're working on questions around success and failure, for example, the School of Life. You have a story about somebody like Hamlet, and, you know, Hamlet has lots of problems with his personality. He's mean to his girlfriend. He's, you know, incredibly indecisive. He ends up causing a lot of death and havoc. But when you watch Hamlet, you also feel for him, and you see how he got there, and you see how he's stuck in a court that is extremely disorienting, and how lots of bad things have happened to him. And you can see how one could be Hamlet. How one could end up being Hamlet. And I think this is a much better way of looking at the world, because suddenly people become intelligible to us, and even if they're bad, less scary. And also it means that we're able to be self-reflexive about it and say, am I Hamlet in some ways? Am I overly indecisive? You know, et cetera. And the news is doing the opposite of that right now, right? It's painting people who are just bad, somehow, usually intrinsically. There's no real explanation for how they got to be bad. And there's no real mechanism, therefore, either of in any way redeeming or complexifying their stories or understanding ourselves through the lens of their news story. And I think that's really unfortunate for our social cohesion as a society and also for our understanding of ourselves.
When I write my biography, by the way, it's going to be called Crushed in the Fangs of Hungry Journalists. I love that.
That is, yes, fantastic. That, I want a credit.
That is such a great expression. I just visualize myself because I was, in fairness, I was crushed a couple of times and I got really angry about it. Now, if anyone slagged me off now, I wouldn't give a damn. I'm so much wiser and older and have done so much reading in this podcast that it wouldn't affect me nearly as much as it did. But at the time, it was pretty crushing. It felt that people in responsible jobs doing irresponsible journalism was really poor to me. Another thing on that, which I love in the book again, is the media portrays itself as an organizations that are saving us, and this is the fascinating thing. Right. So they constantly just do this thing like, we found a tax dodger, or we found a like some sort of corporation thing or something like that. So without us, you would be in all sorts of trouble. Yeah, as you pointed out right at the beginning, they don't every day go, look, the planet's burning up, guys. Do you know what I mean? We need to do a worldwide, you know, as a world, we need to get together and work out how we're gonna get energy for this planet. And we've got to stop making it into a profitable organization. It's got to be functional. It's got to be non-profit. And we've got to work out how we get all the energy to the whole world without ruining our planet. They're not doing that. They're going, this man here stole the charity box in a shop. And without us, you would never know about these cruel people. And that is, you know, this is the thing. They're constantly holding themselves up as our safety net. And basically without them, the world is gonna collapse. That's correct, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're trying really hard to re-examine our intuitions in this book about what the media is. And I think one of the first things it's important to disabuse ourselves of is this false piety about it, right? It's understandable in a way that we have these sort of liberal institutions that we are overly pious about as a society, and we think, oh, it's excellent that we have, you know, an impartial legal system and the media reports on the government and so on. And yes, there's something to that sometimes, but in reality, many of the institutions either don't do what they claim to do or do lots of other bad things as well. And I think the media is a perfect example. So, of course, sometimes they reveal important information about our, errant prime minister or whatever. But they also do a lot of things that are actively harmful to society as well. And yet they get to kind of be clothed in the, let's say, pious robes of an important and impartial arbiter instead of a person, an institution with responsibilities that it's not fulfilling. And I think only once we kind of disabuse ourselves of this as consumers of the news can we begin to think about it differently. We have to start with the idea that, like, this is not an impartial body. In any case, whatever I'm reading is almost never impartial. And also that even if we get a couple of important news stories a year that we appreciate having, all of the noise and stress and anxiety and frustration about things we often can't do anything about in between might not always be worth that cost of being constantly plugged in.
Yeah, and it gets back to the bit which really hit home with me in your book is the search for monsters. That media are like the modern day vampire hunters. They're going around. That's how they're selling themselves.
Yeah.
Without us, you're not going to find the vampires living in amongst you. We're finding them, and we're outing them, and that's what our job is. And when they do find them, there is a complete pile-on, which is, I'm repeating myself a bit here, but there's a complete pile-on without ever going back to the fact that this person might have had a horrific time or a horrific childhood or something might have caused them to. I have watched my industry create so many people and then absolutely hammer them for what they actually are at the beginning. Right. And I watched one the other day who they were trying to get through the door into the world of reality and celebrity, and I was watching it all happen online. I won't go into the details of it. And then the person broke cover before they managed, before all the producers had managed to throw them on the TV. So the person had managed to create themselves into a monster before they actually made it into fame. I was watching and going, there's no way this person's going to succeed on TV because their views are too way out there. And it's like, you know, it was never going to happen, but it was colorful and people were being attracted to it. And so, you know, so the media came, you know, driving in on their horses to grab the person and make them into a celebrity. What is the definition of media? What do we think it is? How do we define media?
I mean, look, there's lots of ways you could look at it, but at least in the way that we are talking about it in our book here, we're looking at a sort of institution that gives us the sense that we need to be constantly consuming the many formats of media, right? So anything from an Instagram post to sort of the radio in the background in the morning, in order to get some kind of impression of what's happening out in the world. And that's why part of the end of our book is thinking about if there are other ways that we can be clued into the world around us that aren't about consuming media, that it might be just as important for you to talk to your neighbor about how their life is going than to understand sometimes what's happening, you know, I don't know, in a spat between celebrities, which is, it turns out, a huge part of the news industry. It's much more important to know what your neighbor is up to than any celebrity by almost any stretch of the imagination, right? And similarly, we can't really watch every part of our government at all times. We had better take our pick of which things we're going to care about, probably in some area where we could do something, and so on.
Yeah, I think one of the good thing about the book is I did a lot of self-examination. And if you're listening to this and you read the book, you will examine yourself and go, oh, hold on, I'm a bit like that. And so you mentioned gossip there. I don't want to be involved in gossip, but I bloody am. You know, I can't help myself. And I think there's something about human nature. Even if you talk football, the gossip at who's being transferred to who or what's happening, and then every now and then one of your mates say, "Have you heard what's happening in the dressing room at so and so?" And you're like, "What? Tell me." You know, and I think is this our thirst for knowledge? And I imagine it's a survival thing, isn't it? The more knowledge we have as a human, the more chance we have of surviving. And that's what we're programmed to do. So we love a bit of gossip about anything and anyone, but it's moved into horrific stuff where you're gossiping about someone who lives across the pond. You know, who gives a damn what they do over in LA in Hollywood?
America is irrelevant, I promise. Yeah. Right. Well, I think it's pushing, you know, like anthropologists say that gossip is one of the things that makes us most human, because it's in the sense of unique from many other species. Obviously, we have language, so we can gossip. But also that what we gossip about tends to reflect our concerns about our own life. You know, that's why we love to talk people's affairs, because we're all sort of, oh, gosh, should I have an affair? Is my spouse having an affair? Is that, you know, it's very important if you live in a small social world to know who's sleeping with who, who's honest, who's dishonest, who you can trust, who's likely to stand up for who in an argument, etc. That's really important. But unfortunately, that bit of our brain, which is so deeply drawn into that, more or less by necessity, no matter how much we might moralize about it, seems to be able to do this for people that are really too far away for it to make any sense. And so now, you know, I have to know about people on Love Island, and that's terrible news for me, right? Because I am not actually involved with these people. It'd be much better for me to know what's happening in my workplace. So I think we need to kind of be reflective. Like, maybe gossip isn't bad when it is about our immediate world, though there are risks there too, but it's preposterous that we do it for celebrities, and yet our brains are primed for that.
I'm going to come on to Love Island in a minute, because I think that's I do think that's really, really important in this whole conversation about media. By the way, your chapter on fame, again, you nailed it. Famous people like me, we're all a bit.
I think you should write a book about fame.
Maybe I should. But
and you can cite us extensively.
Yeah, it's great. Basically, you just say all famous people are mental, and it kind of like roughly that's it.
Just look at the writers anytime we run an event. You know, just check who's asking for what backstage, and you'll know.
All right, but I think there's a pressure to be informed, isn't there? In my job, I have a huge pressure. I remember trying to keep up with it all, and it's just, there's so many celebrities now. It's, I mean, if I go to an awards ceremony, the people that I call proper celebrities, like music people and actors and stuff like that, they're irrelevant. The people want the reality stars. They want the Love Island contestants and stuff like that. That's what people are really interested. They love all that. But I try and stay informed. And I remember trying to learn about, I have never watched one episode of the Kardashians because I refuse to watch other people's lives rather than live my own. I just think that is,
right.
I'm not doing it. I refuse to do it. Right. And so, and then I'm just like, God, there's so many of them. And what are they? And it's kind of like, so I sort of know about Kim and sex tapes and Kanye and all that sort of stuff. But the rest of them, I thought I'm giving up on this. But then I feel this huge pressure because of my job, because I work on TV and I have to interview celebrity all the time, that I should bloody know who the Kardashians are and who the, you know, their entourage is. And I've got to give up at that stage. I can't keep on doing that. But that's sort of trivial knowledge. However, there is the new knowledge, which is the political knowledge. And then someone invented this thing, which I thought was one of the worst things that's ever been invented, which is silence is violence. That expression where if I'm not commenting on the latest thing which is happening, Black Lives Matter, trans issues, da da da, my silence is as bad as me making a comment. I just thought, hold on a second. Well, I've got to get myself informed about every single thing out there. And even saying this, I feel like I'm letting people down by not saying I'm informed enough. But I just don't have the capacity to know everything about everything. And so there is a lot of pressure on us all to know and have opinions.
Yeah, I think that's right, with caveats. I mean, I think, look, the original usage of silence is violence is generally about people in direct positions of power who are able to, in some way, influence an issue and choose to say nothing, right? So, like, a classic example is when Thatcher and Reagan were fairly silent on the AIDS crisis. And they were obviously in a position of power to help with it. So I think in that kind of context, and even in slightly less obvious context where, let's say, I don't know, Rishi Sunak isn't commenting on something with inflation or whatever, or maybe like a very major university that's had a bunch of suicides isn't commenting on the student suicides or whatever, then in those situations the phrase has important meaning. But I think it is true that because we live in a very opinionated media sphere where, as you say, sort of opinion is what gets a lot of the attention, and it's also a sphere where everyone is competing to be like a mini celebrity and like therefore thinks about themselves as deeply important. It's sort of spread to all of us. And I think that's where it becomes more troubling, right? I mean, the poor politicians, they really do, at least within a certain degree, by a very large team of researchers, need to know about all kinds of issues. And if they are silent on some of them, that's a real problem. But in the nicest way possible, you know, you're a podcast host at the end of the day, and you can't comment on everything. And that's probably okay, unless it's something you've otherwise extensively covered in your podcast series, right? And so I think there maybe the part of the problem also is that we've, by making everything sort of individual and opinionated and about people's individual good and bad characteristics and morals, we've missed the big picture, which is who has any power to change this and what do we need them to do? And then how do we get them to do it? And unless you get to a very influential position in something, then that phrase might not be as relevant for someone like you, who's basically somebody who hosts guests on a podcast.
Yeah, what's really interesting though is every time I meet a celebrity and we have this conversation a lot, is they feel unbelievable pressure to use their platform. And I'm like, what is your platform? Like, a load of people who care, you know, what is my platform? There's Tim, works on a Sunday morning show and likes podcasting about stuff, and he, you know, used to work on a football show and stuff like that. What is my opinion got to do with anything? But apparently I've got this platform to change everyone's minds. I'm not sure I have, and I'm not sure it's what I want to do. What I'd rather do is with long form conversation like this. So, you know, drug reform, hopefully there's enough being said in this podcast that'll make people think about how they view the media and maybe have another look at it. That's what I think is important. But for a tweet, like, Jesus, what is that going to achieve? And I'm watching all these celebrities out there going, I'm using my platform. And like, no, you're just creating arguments on your timeline. That is all you're you make a comment and then the arguments happen. Interestingly, when social media first started, my friend Michael, who's a bit of a social commentator, journalist, he said, he said, we're going to find out. He goes, I'm really interested in social media because we're going to find out what the public think, and it's not going to be pretty. And I think he hit it there, because there was a lot when it first started, there was a lot of racism, a lot of sexism, there still is, but I mean, it was huge because no one thought there was any consequences. Then the police started putting people in prison for it when they were doing it to celebrities and stuff. And then there was suddenly people going pylons, as they call it. And then people started getting cancelled. And the public have had to learn that they're not allowed to actually project their own opinions out there. They've got to go, what's the opinion I need? And then they project that out there. Which side do I? And what we've ended up is this is just my opinion, is there's no nuance between, say, left and right. It's you're either left or you're right. It's either black or it's white. And you pick a side and then you argue that side. You die on that hill. You can't sit in the middle somewhere, because that's not the place to be. You can never sit in the middle. And you've only got a certain amount of words to say it, or a picture or something. So you've got to pick your side of what side you're on, or the fashionable thing for the opinion for that day. But God help you if you don't have it. You've got to have your opinion, and that's where we're at. So it's actually, bizarrely, media has leaked into all our lives now, and we've all become little media moguls with our social media. Right. I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's very dangerous. And in addition to working at the School of Life and on this book and so on, I'm a researcher at Oxford University looking at psychology and politics. So this is very much my area of interest. And I think something that's really dangerous about this, particularly what I relate to and what you've just said, is this point that now that we're all being asked to state our opinions at all times, we kind of feel pressured into taking a position, and generally one that's very, very clear in one direction or another. I think that the danger there is, well, there are lots of things, but one of them is that it turns out that once we make and commit to something, an opinion, we actually come to believe it more. A lot of the time, there's quite a bit of research on how essentially we need to align our actions and our beliefs. And so if we do something even offhand, like agree to go to one protest or install solar panels on our roof or engage in some racist banter, and obviously these are a range of good or bad things, we then move our views towards our actions to reduce any possible dissonance we might feel about it, right? So if we're constantly being asked to take positions on things very quickly, we're going to end up stating lots of things in the public, which we then come to believe more and more and be able sometimes to be less critical about in the future. That's dangerous. And the other thing is, and I think this is where we really have to untie our bad intuitions. And I would even say that they're liberal intuitions, in the sense that they have to do with a certain idealized image of like a liberal public sphere where everyone can say whatever they want, and that's what makes things good and work. Is that, to be frank, I don't think we do our best thinking as human beings when we're sort of sitting in the abstract spouting opinions. And there's lots of good reasons to believe this. But one of the main reasons is that it may be that we're only capable of really learning certain things by actively trying to change the world, right? Because, of course, depending on where you grew up, you're generally going to believe something in the ecosystem of beliefs around you. That's why, Christian fundamentalists have baby Christian fundamentalists on average much more than other people, and so on. Right. And we're dependent on other people to develop our views. So just spouting views is not necessarily a process of thinking, even though it feels like one. And I would say that really thinking about politics or any other major social issue that is political in some way means going out in the world and trying to do something about it. And then you really learn how the thing works, right? And so I tend to trust people much more who have said something like, I care a lot about, sexual harassment, and I work in that field, or I talk to lots of people who've experienced it, or I, whatever it is. Because just having an opinion is almost misleading in a way. And I think it's actually action that has to come first before we can reason well about something, rather than this sort of abstract reasoning that we tend to think of as thinking.
Yeah, I'm confused about that. I don't know. I watch a lot of people tweet about, say, a very good example of this is American politics, right? Mm-hmm. We're in Britain. A lot of my friends tweet anti-Trump stuff or whatever's going on, in America. And half of me thinks that's good because it's raising awareness that there's more people who are not interested in it. But the other bit of it makes me think, what is the point? You don't have a vote in America. So why are you spending time talking about American politics. And I wonder if American politics, I've had this conversation a few times in this podcast. I wonder if American problems and politics, it's a very different country in my mind.
It is, when I visited, yeah, I promise.
Very bloody different country. I loved visiting America. I love Americans. I think that I love the country, but I think this country is a lot better socially. Just take the NHS, for God's sake, and the fact we don't have guns.
Yeah, I agree.
And you know, and I think that America has a lot of problems.
As an SKP, I agree.
Yeah, they got a lot of problems, a lot of racism over there. And I think we're exporting their problems over here, or importing, sorry, by engaging so much. America has become so massive in the world, and it always has been. But now their news, their 24-hour news is leaking more and more into our 24-hour news. We're seeing it more with their mass shootings and everything. And I think I feel sometimes my daughters are studying history and politics, and they talk a lot about American politics like it's ours. They will give me a fact on America. Do you know how much the da-da-da? And I'm like, no, it's America. Well, tell me about Britain or somewhere else, France. We live right next door to France, you know, but they don't know America is. And it's really interesting that I wonder if, as you say, if you start talking about it, you start living it. I wonder if the younger generation is starting to feel they're living in America with a, how many states are there in America now? 50, what
50,
is it?
Yeah.
50. So we're the 51st state then, maybe.
Right.
I think you're right.
But it's a fake source of knowledge, right? To imagine you live. And I actually think even I have to be very careful about this, because I am an American, but I haven't lived there since I was 22 years old. And so I really don't know what it's like to be an American in a lot of ways. It's a very fraught thing for me as well. You know, I don't really know what it's like to be terrified that one wrong step and I'm without any way of paying for healthcare in a way that my friends who have left behind there do have to think about, for example. So I think what you're saying is actually aligned with what I said previously, which is that it's only by actually going out and doing things that we can achieve certain kinds of knowledge, imperfect though they may be, And that instead, a lot of the time, our media sphere is perfectly happy to simply amplify the voices of people who just have opinions, or who think that just by argumentation we can get somewhere. And there's even this imaginary feeling of living, you know, as someone else. Like, oh, I've read a lot about America, and now I have an opinion, and I almost feel as though I've lived there, right? It's almost as though America is a celebrity, and we're all living psychologically through the celebrity lifestyle of the Americans, except, unfortunately, this celebrity is having a sort of semi-fascist general meltdown, and we also live through the, you know, the extended drama of the America celebrity movement or whatever. So I agree with you,
At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste, like juicy heirloom tomatoes, cheesy house-made pizza, and fresh artisan-made bread. From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
Do you think humans are intrinsically evil people, really?
I don't know. I think actually morality is something that we love to plaster on top of systems that just are. Like, I don't think we're inherently good either. I think we're just sweet little biological systems living together in social units trying to survive. And the evil and the good that come out of that.
there are apparently there were 9 different species of humans, and we're the ones at the top, and we're the only ones surviving. I read that once somewhere. I imagine we didn't get to the top I didn't think we got to the top by being nice, did we?
I think it depends because there are lots of things. Go on, sorry.
I don't know. If you look at the way just look at the British Empire, look at slavery, look at all the other things. I don't think humans are particularly nice, and I think we like to think we're wonderful people, but the hangover's still there, and we're still absolutely fixated with jealousy, and we like to see others fail. That's one of the bits in your book I'm getting at.
We
like to see others fail, and it's something that is ingrained in us, and we're jealous. We're very jealous, and we love it when we see a celebrity fall off out of favor, and we love to see when apparently, because they sell well, those magazines and all the internet these days, when you see a celebrity and they're out shopping, and you know, there's, I don't know, whatever they call it these days, there's a roll of fat hanging out or something like that on some woman, or there's a guy who looks 100 years old, and you know, you point this out constantly.
We just mock them.
We love it to see the guy with the multi-million pounds who suddenly looks rough, and it's like, yeah, I suppose that makes us feel nice, makes us feel normal.
Yeah, I think I don't exactly disagree with you. I just see it in a more complex way. I think we've got the equipment, let's say, to be terrible. And there's no, I mean, look, I'm the grandchild of a Holocaust survivor. There's no making the face of humanity prettier than it is. But I also think that the sort of the way that we use the hardware that we've got, let's say, can vary so dramatically that it almost becomes bizarre to think about ourselves as either intrinsically good or bad. And the reason that I think that hardware tends to vary so dramatically is just the circumstances that we're put in. Because it does seem also that when we are put in circumstances where we survive better via cooperation and relative niceness, we do very well at that too. I think basically we just use the systems that get us ahead. But we can build systems where what gets us ahead is being more or less decent and kind most of the time, or even just forward-thinking and rational in a certain sense. And the thing that most recently reminded me of this, once you peel back the sort of American imperialism from the cover of it, is the launching of the telescope recently. I watched a BBC documentary on this. And the thing is incredible. It's incredible not just because there's lots of cool science and weird special materials, but it's that it took 40 years, that any one thing going wrong could have screwed it up, and that people from across every single, you know, continent worked on it for that long, launched something, and are just using it to understand science. I mean, there's lots of other complicated things going on there with, like, the defense industry and whatever, but overall, when I watched it, I thought, oh my gosh, this, I almost don't recognize the species, but this is my own species of people working together slowly, patiently, for a really long time. And I realized that that's just because in their field, that is what is rewarded. And so I guess my view is, if we were to think about this politically in the long run, what we have to do is neither think about ourselves as good or bad, but think about building a world where being reasonably good most of the time is a thing that gets you to a good place in life. And I think if we did that, humans could be good in a sense, mostly.
Right, good or bad. I just think we are, like you say, we are who we are. And I think this is the good thing about I got from the book is just recognizing we are who we are. I agree with you, that telescope is amazing. But the ratings of that documentary would be crap because people aren't interested in that. What the ratings are, good.
I think everyone should go watch it.
Well,
and give it a good rating too. Yeah, come
they
on.
Should, but the ratings which are good are Love Island. So I said I was going to talk about that. So let's go into Love Island. So I watched I watched an episode years ago, a series years ago, because my teenage daughters were watching it, and I thought, well, I've always said, you know, I've got to go to them; they can't come to me. So I decided to sit down and watch it, and I got captivated by it. I completely bought into it. I watched one series. When it came around to the next series, I was like, what we're doing is we're taking young people. And we're putting them on a TV show, and then we're torturing them with love. So we're saying, "Come on, all pair up! Now we're going to muck about with your brains and your mind." And then what we do is we say they know what they're getting themselves into, right? Which they don't. They clearly don't, because they go in there thinking that everyone's going to love them, and then they walk out of there and they go, "Hold on a second, I didn't know that was my nose," or you know, it's like all these things. And then what happens is they mess about with these guys' minds in there. They come out, and then some of them are picked up and made to be massive heroes and make an absolute fortune for a couple of years, and then they drop out of the limelight when the next lot comes along. We are playing games with these people, but it's not just that. That when you're watching it, why are you watching it? Because my social media fills up all the time. They go, "I can't believe he did that," or "I'm going to complain to Ofcom about her or him," or something like that. We are getting so engrossed in people's bad behavior. What the fuck are you expecting when you're watching that show? Of course they're going to behave badly. And what are the producers and everyone thinking about it? Everybody knows what they're getting. Everybody who's taking part in it. From the viewer to the contestants, to the producer. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but don't try and start going, "Be kind, hashtag be kind, be kind," because you know what's going to happen. It's happened every series. Someone comes along and plays a game. There's narcissists, there's horrible people, there's nice people, there's people getting upset. It's just a crap human zoo, and you're playing with people's emotions. It's nothing else. Now, if you're getting off on watching that, then you're getting off on watching it. Don't beat yourself up about it, but then don't go around saying, "Can everyone be kind?" Because you're part of watching the old fashioned gladiatorial crap going on, aren't you? So, you know, it frustrates me a bit that we then all look away and we all go, "No, we're really nice people." Wait, hold on, you're tuning in to watch people cry I suppose the added side to this is with my rant here is why are we doing it? And I think we want the artificial emotions, don't we? I think that is what we're mm-hmm. buying into. We're sitting in our lives, maybe like Kardashians, whatever. We're not excited about our own lives. Let's borrow somebody else's emotions. And that's basically what we're doing. And we can borrow them for an hour and then switch them off or go onto social media. Do you think I've got some sort of validity in what I'm saying?
I think you're right. Yeah, I think we get to live viscerally these super intense emotions, which masks the fact that probably, for one thing, in a lot of our lives, we feel bored. Right? You know, I mean, our lives are monotonous.
Yeah. But that is actually living. That people forget.
It is actually living. I mean, I think we have choices, right? So in a dream universe, in my view, we would shut off Love Island and go and you know, if we're bored, we would, I don't know, build a new cool community center or go on a massive hike or something. But in fact, the shortcut is Love Island, it turns out.
But that's my argument with you. My argument with this is why are we shutting off? We've got to understand that's who we are still. We're not very nice. Because I got into it and I understood it and I couldn't wait to watch next week's episode, the next day's episode, because I'm not a very nice person. I want to watch these people suffer a bit and I want to see it all happen. Clearly there's some side of me which does that. But then don't walk away from it and think I'm a bloody saint and that, nothing. I enjoyed it. Now, whether it should be on TV or not, I don't know. That's somebody else's decision. But if you are watching it, I'm not saying you're a bad person, but understand that you're getting off on watching people get really upset, or, you know, there's the ups and downs and the highs and the lows. It's a really weird thing. And you know, to understand it, and then to understand that those people, once we finish with them, they have to come into the real world. And being on TV. Yeah. I know the real world can be quite horrible when you're on social media, and that's what they've got to deal with after it. Sorry, I interrupted you there.
No, absolutely. I was just going to add that I think the other thing that we get out of it, besides something very seemingly exciting in the middle of monotony of our ordinary lives, which we should make more interesting in reality, is moralism, right? And but moralism is quite boring most of the time. It's the idea of saying, oh, well, those people were, you know, gaslighting and screaming and yelling at each other, but I don't do that in my life, right? And it gives us a way of feeling better about our own lives, because they're not quite as much of an absolute shit show as that.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite telling also. Yeah. And I think all of us are really guilty of that, pretty much. I don't know anyone who isn't enjoying that bit.
Though being mundane is the meaning of life, I've decided doing nothing is the meaning of life. And every time you add something into it, you're ruining your life. But you might be ruining it for a good reason. So you're going to go and skydive, then you might be ruining it for a buzz and a good reason. So it could be a good idea. But if everyone understands that doing nothing and watching the plants grow is actually living, that's not boredom, that's not mundane, that is being alive. If you can get off on being alive, then I think you've got half a chance in life. Now, the problem with the media, even every advertising, every advert at the moment, you know, we've got the world, you know, dying around us, and yet constant, win a holiday, go on holiday, do this, travel the world. Can't tell you how many travel programs there are out there. Go and see turtles in so-and-so. No, stay at home, go to the local. I'm not saying, by the way, I love traveling and I have traveled loads in my life, and I'm being hypocritical here, but we're told, like, bucket list, the worst thing in the world is a bucket list. The bucket list should be get up, live, enjoy the life, smell the roses because they're lovely and they smell lovely, go to bed, and then wake up the next day and go, I'm still alive again. It's fantastic. This is amazing. But the media, again, are the ones who keep on saying, what? Like, so I just want to quickly get onto FOMO here, because when I talked to Oliver Berkman with his brilliant book about time, he says it's impossible not to miss out now, because there are so many options open to us, and the media are again not their problem, but they're perpetrating it. So you just have to tune into any news, any one of the channels, and they'll have people visiting planets all over the world, people doing up their houses, people buying exciting houses, people all sorts of exciting things that you're not doing, and it makes you feel shit.
Right. Yeah. I think, look, we often phrase this as a fight between a romantic and classical understanding of life. And we're obviously sort of using two very large genres of, I don't know, intellectual thought to stand for something here. But in classical thought, the most important things are the things that are always happening, that are continuous throughout time. So, like, trees growing is extremely important. and very long-term relationships and so on. And in the romantic vision, it's the new and the immediate and the visceral and the like deeply felt and the shockingly original that are important. And there's something to both of these, of course, in some ways, but we might be very heavily biased towards the second in our current society, and the news is taking advantage of that, plus probably various neural pathways, to get us to be fascinated by, you know, oh my gosh, I could go somewhere else. But as we point out, you know, if you go somewhere else, you'll still be stuck with yourself. All of your normal anxieties, the same to-do list in your head, the same possibly broken relationships in your everyday life. And it might actually be very exciting to stay put and to look at the local turtles, you know, and maybe plant some trees and talk to your spouse a little bit more for once about something other than what the children have to do next. And that's exciting too. But we have to rethink what exciting means.
It was a realization of mine years ago that I when I went on holiday, I had to take myself with me. And what I was trying to do is get away from, because I was, you know, I had depression and I wanted to go on holiday to get away from me, but I'd arrive and I'd just have depression in another country rather than, I mean, all this podcasting and reading and self-awareness has really helped me. And I don't feel that way anymore. You know, I never say I can't go back there, but I think this is knowledge is fantastic. And learning a bit about myself is great, and that's why I say this book is so important. The one other thing I want to get to before we come to the end of the time is the empathy overload, as I used to call it. But I'm desperately searching through the book here to find the chapter about
we talk about empathy.
I find it, but you talk about like there's some atrocity, some kid will die of cancer who's got nothing to do with you at all, and then the next day you wake up and you've borrowed the emotions. And then you've lived the emotions, you've felt terrible about the poor kid dying of cancer. And then the next day you wake up and it's like you've just wandered away from it because you've just borrowed. I think you used the word borrowed and I can't remember. I don't want to misquote you. And
then you've done a cheap loan, let's say.
All right, and then there's something horrific going on in Asia or Africa or another part of Europe or something. And then we all buy into it. And then, you know, but we're not actually living it. We're sort of fake. And is it actually beneficial to us, ourselves? You feel inclined to feel the empathy and have it, but we're getting so much of it now, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that this bit of the book is one of my favorites too. And basically the answer is no, it's not that good that we're feeling empathy all the time. I really like also a book about this called Against Empathy by Paul Bloom, where he talks about all the different ways that empathy is just constantly misused. And we talk about it as, remember, empathy is a tool, right? Like actually all of our emotions are there sort of to help us get somewhere in life. And empathy is fascinating. Many aliens might be jealous if they don't have the ability to put myself in the position of what is it like, you know, to be Tim Lovejoy or Carrie Johnson or the sad child or whatever. But it's interesting that we can at least try to model other people's life experiences. But as it turns out, first of all, we do it very poorly. We tend to do it better for people that are just like us, where it's least useful. And secondly, we get a kind of thrill out of it that often isn't commensurate with our actual ability to change or help or our real sense of felt responsibility for the people that we're empathizing with. And so the news is perfect for this because we can read about, you know, people having a really horrible time in a refugee camp and maybe we'll even chuck them a couple of quid, but we're sort of getting more out of that experience arguably at a sort of thrill level. Then we are taking a real sense of responsibility for it. And often we're doing nothing for those people at all. And so we're asking people to be critical about whether empathy is always a moral good or whether it's merely an ability that we have that we often can misuse.
Yeah, there's a lot of people at the moment who people like to label themselves, don't they? I'm an extrovert, I'm an introvert, I'm a this, I'm a that. And people like to have that label. It helps them, I think, with their identity. But the latest one that I hear all the time is I'm an empath.
Yes.
And I just think every time someone says that to me, I'm like, oh God, so you care more than me, do you? That's what you're basically saying. I'm an empath. I care so much about everybody.
Right.
But I was thinking after reading this book, the word empath is probably become so prolific because people are watching so much media. They feel that they are feeling this sympathy constantly because it's being force fed down their throats with them by if you're watching 24-hour news like I do. I'm trying to, by the way, I'm trying to get rid of 24-hour news, but I can't do it. It's really, really hard.
It's an addiction.
it is an absolute addiction. So you know, I think the beauty of this book is it's made me understand me a bit. I'm not a particularly, you know, I'm not a bad person, but I also need to work on the way on some of the things.
You're stuck in a system that prioritizes certain things that are not great.
Yeah, I always think if you look back in history, right, mm-hmm. you know, you go to Roman times, I mean, you get news maybe once a month or something. You get gossip, wouldn't you? But, you know, you'd get proper news. You wouldn't get to hear all this news. You know, you wouldn't
understand
that.
And it might be quite relevant to your life also, right? Oh, yeah, I can do this differently now, right?
Well, you'd be there, and then you'd be a Roman, and then you'd hear about the Romans turning up in England, and they didn't take the right footwear, and it's raining over there and stuff. And then you'd probably hear about that, and yeah, all that sort of stuff. Oh, they all got foot rot, and you'd did you hear about the Romans going to England or whatever? But you wouldn't. Yeah. You'd hear about that months later, and it's moving so quickly now. I suppose that we're kind of coming to the end of this interview. What would you say then for people? I mean, I think everyone should read this book. By the way, I think if you're interested in this, we're tip of the iceberg here. It opened my mind to so much stuff. It's such a great book. But for Golden, what are the sort of general rules, apart from understanding yourself, what do you think you should do to try and navigate the world of media?
Well, first of all, you should buy and read our book, obviously. But secondly, I think that news should only follow from what we can reasonably expect to gain from it. And so there's a sort of nice jargon that I actually think is great, the idea of the media diet. But I think people often apply that in quite a limited way. So they say, you know, okay, I'm only going to check this once a day, or, you know, I'm only going to read from reputable sources, or I'm only going to whatever. I'm going to make sure I read something on climate change. And that's all perfectly valid in its own space. But I also think we need to think more broadly about what it means to have a diet. And I obviously don't mean this in a horrible weight loss way, but in the sense of choosing what we consume and broaden that. To say, I'm going to think about what I actually need. So, for example, I think people should be consuming news about politics, but I would strongly encourage them to think about ways they could actually get involved in politics that would be meaningful to them, and then consume news on the basis of that, right? If you, for example, think that the education system is absolutely bizarrely bad, which is often true in this country, in my humble opinion, then you should read news about education policy, which no one does enough, right? And then maybe you don't need to read every other piece of news about the latest, I don't know, every Tory MP seems to be a sex pest right now. Maybe that's not, I mean, it's not great, but maybe you don't need to consume all the news about that. So I think there's something about putting what we want to do in our lives first and consuming news at least somewhat in relation to that. And I think also we need to broaden our sense of what's urgent to move beyond anything that's in the media industrial complex, right? And to say, you know, it's also extremely important whether the elderly people in my apartment block are being taken care of. And that's not on the news. And it's also very, very important whether we've planted enough trees in my local place, even if that's never going to be in the news. And you know, it's very important whether my spouse is feeling a bit depressed this month, and that's never going to be in the news, and so on. That we have to reorient our lives to think about what's meaningful and actionable, and then the news maybe can come in sort of at the end stage of that in some way if it's helpful.
Do you feel though guilty about if you're going to ignore Tory sex pests, do you feel guilty that there are victims at the end of that story who have been abused in some way, and that if you're not giving it the time of day, that you're part of the problem because you're not giving it the awareness? That I'm just putting this out there because that's how people feel, isn't it? I need to have an opinion on this because I've got to feel sorry for somebody. Come on, you know, it's quite hard, isn't it?
I've always liked the phrase, abuse of power comes as no surprise. I think it's a lovely phrase in the activist community. And the answer is basically, don't spend time being shocked and frightened. You know, of course, like, we have a system that encourages a bunch of people to spend years sucking up to one another to have minor parts of political power. And it turns out precisely those people are also very happy once they have that power to abuse it for sex. Like, that doesn't surprise me at all. So I think there's no point in, like, doing the shock and horror bit of that generally. And I think, secondly, I don't feel guilty because I don't think that what's actually owed to people that have had a terrible time is just me paying attention to it. My attention is a limited and easily expended resource that will go nowhere unless I focus it also on action. And it needs to have a relationship to action. So I'm not doing them any justice just by knowing something bad happened to them. It would be justice if I can vote out their Tory sex pest, but I can't, sadly. Or if I can, you know, I don't know, create more counseling for them or something. But generally speaking, just to know doesn't necessarily do them any good.
one of the, actually to know about these things these days doesn't seem to matter anyway, because there seems to be no consequences to any actions which go on.
It's shocking,
often,
isn't it?
which is just really, really strange. Sort of started by the sort of, oh, I don't want to get political. I'll stop there. But you know, we used to have real good, bad consequences for anything, even like a lie. And now there's no consequences for any of it at all. Yeah. One of the first things I learned.
Because people have gone exhausted. Yeah,
exactly. One of the first things I ever learned when, oh, the media move on as well. Like,
right, that's true. They don't.
But Boris Johnson, let's just take him for an example, because he's the one who's relevant at the moment. Mm. He just goes, the public want to move on. And it's like he's trying to move the media on. And rather than them go, no, we're not moving on until we're going to every single day ask you about this party or something because everyone else was locked in. They move on. Why the media do move on? And it's like Boris knows that. They're so aware they'll just move on. They'll wait for something else to happen, which will move them on. So, you know, so I suppose that's that he's correct in that. One of the first things I learned when I decided to read my way out of depression or attempt to was if you think life's fair, then you've got a rude awakening. If you get up every day and think life's not fair and shit happens, you've got half a chance. And I think that's very important. And the final thing I'll say on this, which is there's an old Chinese proverb, and I can't remember what it is, but I can tell you the crux of it, which is be careful what goes in you and be careful what comes out of you. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought about that. And what comes out of you, what they mean by that is what you're saying. So if you're a gossip or a gossip monger, so be careful of that because it could come back. But also be very careful what goes in you, because whatever goes in you, you become. So if you are sitting, and this is a point actually is made in this book, if you are constantly watching death and destroy and misery, and you know, if you get really caught up in political things, you will become that ball of negative energy or the energy you're doing. And so you've got to be careful what you're putting inside you. And so I'm very careful now what I'm consuming to make sure that it's not something, even though I'm addicted to the news, I'm very careful that I'm not consuming too much of it, because you can't get rid of it. Once it's in, that's it, isn't it?
I think that's right. That's about the point earlier where we make monsters, right? The problem is ultimately, sorry, Tim, not really about whether we see you as a monster, as important as you are, but it's that now that we have a news cycle that is about this kind of thing, we no longer can see ourselves except in this extremely rigid framework of good, bad, monster, you know, whatever. We don't have the complexity available to us in our daily lives. And that's a real problem, really, because you obviously have grown and matured and moved beyond whatever those journalists could do to you. But, you know, as a whole, as a society, we need a broader vocabulary for what's happening.
Maybe. Brilliant. Listen, thank you so much for joining me. And as I say, I can't recommend this book enough. It's by The School of Life, and it's How Modern Media Destroys Our Mind. Fantastic books, made a massive impact on me and the way I think. So I recommend you buy it. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Giant Eagle, we believe in better, and that includes finding more ways to help you save. Because finding a good deal is everyone's deal. Because every dollar and every moment counts. On sale this season at Giant Eagle, you'll find lower prices on hundreds of favorites, like seedless grapes, ground beef, Giant Eagle American cheese, and more. Giant Eagle, because it matters. Limited time only through September 9th, 2026. Prices and participation may vary. See store for details.